Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for May 31st, 2018, the Ambien and Racism edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura, here together with my confreres in the CBS radio studio. John Dickerson of CBS This Morning, thanks for having us. Thanks for hosting us.
It's great to be with you all. I love when we're together.
I love when we're together too.
Did you say with you all if it's just the two of us? Isn't it with you both? Or would you, do you still say with you
like
all?
All together, right?
No, you would. Does the all encompass John as well? Because then it would be all.
No, you're exactly right. I think it should be with you both, but I am so overwhelmed by the all that it's just I'm surprised I didn't start the sentence with it.
It's as if we've been fruitful and multiplied in this very room.
Exactly. That, of course, is Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
Emily's down from New Haven. I'm up from Washington. John is merely here.
Always.
Yeah. And that's pretty much the way people feel about the show and my presence.
Merely here will be on the tombstone, the Dickerson tombstone. On this week's Gabfest, did the Trump administration lose 1,500 children, or did they do something much worse than the catastrophe in Puerto Rico was even more deadly than we knew? How much blame does the president deserve? How much blame do we, American citizens, and we, American journalists, deserve for our neglect of that terrible, terrible disaster? And then the Roseanne furor. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. And before we get any further, we, of course, have a live show coming up in Philadelphia, the Keswick Theater in Glenside, PA, just outside the city, 7:30 p.m. on July 18th. There are tickets available at slate.com/live. Come join us. Eileen Bazelon has not, in fact, bought all tickets yet, apparently. She has
no,
not.
There are a few left. She's left a few.
Come on, Eileen.
nicely done. That's not her generation.
That's my mom. Just by the way, for everybody.
Is she coming?
She's definitely coming. And some of her friends are coming. But other people can still come, too.
All right. Slate.com/live. Get tickets. It's going to be a fun show on July 18th. The Where Are the Children hashtag brought satisfied horror to many liberals this past week, stemming from an initial claim that the Trump administration had lost 1,500 unaccompanied minors who had been picked up crossing the border and placed with caregivers, placed with people who would be responsible for them. This sort of, well, we'll get into the details of it, but this partly true story merged with the all too true story of what the Trump administration is actually doing, the true savagery that's being carried out in our name by the Department of Homeland Security, the policy of separating all children detained crossing the border from their parents, basically by, as Emily, I'm sure, will explain, the policy that stems from charging anyone who is caught crossing the border improperly with a crime and thus putting them in criminal detention, which children are not allowed in, and then casting these children to the wind to foster care or whatever. And this is occurring even in cases where families are seeking asylum. So let's start with the story that is maybe less of a story than people hoped.
No, let's not start there because I feel like this is getting too much attention. Let's do it really contextual.
Fast. John Dickerson, please.
Let me raise my hand.
John Dickerson's raising his hand.
I sympathize with what Mr. you're Dickerson. Saying, Emily, except what I found difficult, and we've gone over this in the age of Trump, but is like, I think I know what you're about to say, and it's a shame that I'm interrupting you because we could just let you say it. But the pulling apart of the spaghetti from the sauce, I think, does feel like it needs to happen in these instances because it's gotten all jumbled up. And so people are emotional based on the thing that's jumbled up. And then it's hard to kind of focus on the thing that it does need our attention, which is what you're saying. And I feel like there's this thing where when you try to explain to people how it's gotten jumbled up, some people will interpret you as if you're making excuses for the administration, and that shouldn't be. We should still be able to explain stuff for the purposes of clarifying and put it in context without being accused of making apologies for the administration. So, having done that, will you explain to us why these two things are different?
Yes, in 30 seconds or less. The government settled about 1,500 unaccompanied minors with people whom the government had vetted, mostly family members. And then the government tried to follow up by placing a phone call. Hey, are you still there? Do you have this kid? A lot of those people could not, in one phone call, be reached. Probably because a lot of them are undocumented and not super eager to stay in touch with not ICE itself, but another connected arm.
The Office of Refugee Resettlement.
Precisely. And so it is not that there are almost 1,500 children who like are gone and probably terrible things have happened to them. It is that they are under the radar for now. And we should be really concerned about what's happening at the border with these separations and have like a tiny
I'm trying to get away from this.
I feel like we spent all week earnestly explaining this.
I still think people get confused. So the first thing that you've explained is an existing program that has been, it's kind of the way it's been done across administrations. These kids come, the Office of Refugee Resettlement sends them to homes.
And with their relatives,
with their relatives,
which is a good idea.
Yeah, which is all good. And it's a good thing for government to be engaged in the checking up on them to make sure that they're okay.
Well, except we don't want them to check up so much that we then put in jeopardy these undocumented people. Like, one of the solutions to the, quote, loss, the more like we haven't totally kept track problem is to start fingerprinting people who want to apply to, and that is a bad idea.
I don't know that that's a bad idea. Why is that such a bad idea?
It's a bad idea because a lot of them are undocumented and the risk to them of being fingerprinted and tracked by ICE is greater than the risk. If you have vetted people and you are handing someone to their relative, then the notion that that relative also needs to be fingerprinted
notion that an unaccompanied child who crosses into the United States is essentially, you know, we put them with someone who's vetted and then they're gone. They're lost to the system. I mean, one of the shocking things to me about the Office of Refugee Resettlement piece is that they consider their responsibility over once the child is placed. I mean, these calls they were making to check up on
were
the kids,
like voluntary.
They were voluntary calls. There's no requirement. Like, basically, these kids who should not be in the country, or it's unclear whether they have the right to be in this country, and certainly someone should be tracking them, seeing if they are entitled to live here, and also seeing if they're getting the proper services and education they need. And we're not doing any of that. And so the idea that you don't track the people they're in the care of seems to me weird.
Monitoring
these are
people,
children who have who are essentially wards of the state in some sense,
but they're not wards of the state exactly. And treating being a ward of the state as reason for, you know, monitoring undocumented families is really risky. We're talking about relative risks here. It's not that there's zero risk to kids when the government doesn't check up, but there is significant risk of detention and deportation right now from the government getting their hands into your life. And that's something we need to be cognizant of.
Go ahead, John.
But also, you don't want to create a system in which any kid that can come, that there's an invitation to come to the border. If you can come to the border, nobody ever checks up on you later. Because then you have the moral hazard problem is that you can basically, if you're a kid, you can flee. And, you know, once you get to the border, you're going to be okay because you'll disappear into the American system.
Right. That's true.
And also, it's not 1,500 kids. I mean, it's 40,000 kids, of which the 1,500 are the ones who
didn't answer the phone. 80 plus percent of them did answer the phone. The question is, what kinds of efforts do we want the government to make? And is the follow-up call enough, or do we want something more rigorous? And something more rigorous is fine with me as long as it is really clear we are not jeopardizing people's status by asking these questions.
Well, I think there's you have to separate the fact that we have, as we'll get to in a second, we have a government whose immigration policies right now is designed to be as cruel and punitive as possible, and therefore any time you expose people who have improper immigration status to them, you're endangering them. And so, of course, you don't want to put these caregivers at risk, and you don't want to put these kids at risk unnecessarily because our federal government is behaving monstrously. Separate that from the fact that 40,000 children showed up in
without a country they don't
and unaccompanied minors they are in the care of the United States government in some sense. And to sort of wash your hands of that, to absolve yourself of any responsibility of keeping track of them, and to then know that when those kids in 10 years want to get they want to get a job. They want to be integrated into society because of...
Well, they're tomorrow's dreamers.
Yeah, they're tomorrow's... That they're not going to be allowed to kind of be that cavalier about tracking them seems weird to me. Seems like you should be tracking them. It's just the fact is that we have this absolutely terrible immigration leadership right now.
Well, right. I mean, it depends which universe you're living in. The more ideal universe that you described versus the universe, which is one in which, separate from this problem, and this has been the confusion, at the border, there are many children who come with families who are crossing illegally, but also with families who perfectly legally are seeking asylum. So in this scenario, you show up at the border because, you know, you feel that you are of terrible risk of violence or death in your home country of El Salvador or Honduras or Guatemala or wherever. You have children. You say, I'm seeking asylum, and they rip your children away from you. And that are the stories we are hearing from some of these challenges. And that is horrifying. And it's happening in the context of a policy that is designed to dramatically increase the numbers. When Caitlin Dickerson of the New York Times reported on this in April, there were 700 of these kids.
No relation to John Dickerson.
Now she thinks those numbers have skyrocketed. Her Twitter feed is a really good one to follow, as is Josie Duffy Rice's. She did like God's work over the weekend of trying to correct some of these errors. Anyway, that is the policy we are looking at right now. And it's also in the context of the Trump administration talking about long-term detention for children separated from their parents. And that is something that should horrify us.
So we're talking now about this, the second thing that has been conflated. And yes, what this is a change in the way in which the Department of Justice chooses to enforce, chooses to basically handle asylum seekers, treating them as criminals. And as a result of treating them as criminals, the children they bring with them are separated from them.
And also effectively treated as criminals.
Well, they're right. And they're
and
this is the new this is the new thing. This is the new thing the administration has been doing in the interpretation of what they're the way they should carry out their jobs. Because the so-called zero tolerance policy is one, to just keep people from coming. And then two, the administration believes people are overusing the asylum claim. Is that essentially?
Yes, and right. So let's play this out. Why do this at the border with asylum seekers? Because you want to deter people from seeking asylum in the United States. And you, federal government, also know that a lot of people apply for asylum and then they get into the country and yes, they have court appearances, they have to prove their claim, they can make they have to show credible fear to a border agent, and then they have to like show up and testify and prove that out, and a lot of them lose. And some of them melt into the fabric of the United States and become undocumented. And because of, you know, what I would call the sort of hysteria of the Trump administration right now about immigration, which is not dramatically on the rise, not some huge threat to the country, because of all of that, this notion that we have to stop people from even trying to seek asylum has kind of taken over. And it's a violation of international law to try to treat people seeking asylum as criminals. Like, it absolutely is.
Does everyone who is caught crossing in an undocumented way, does every single person basically say, I'm seeking asylum? Can you just say it?
Well, once you know, I mean, to present for asylum, you're supposed to present yourself.
You have to voluntarily show up and do it.
Yeah, if you go to a border crossing station, if once they catch you, you can say it, but it's not,
but you're not
the same thing. You've illegally crossed.
So does the deterrent argument have any moral weight? I mean, there is, going back to John's moral hazard point, there's a real problem if people think they can get into the United States without consequence, and so you want to discourage people from doing it.
And you also don't, and this goes to your point about the safety of children, you do not want people to pretend they are parents and, you know, use kids as a way to get in. That is potentially scary.
But so does, can the deterrence argument be justified in this case? Is there any, I mean, certainly DHS and Secretary Nielsen think it's okay.
I mean, I would say no. It's not. Look, immigration policy is incredibly difficult. Many people, Most people do not believe in open borders. And so once you're not in a world of open borders, you're in a world of restrictions and setting lines, and you treat some people differently from others. And during the Obama administration, there was a lot of concern about these family detention centers where they were holding people together. At the time, that seemed bad. But this amping up and, you know, ripping families apart this way, like, that just can't be the right answer. It just cannot. It causes so much human suffering. I just can't believe this is necessary.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me it's immoral. I mean, it's absolutely immoral. It cannot possibly be justified. The separation of families, the separation of parents from children, without there being a kind of, like, you know, clear danger to the rest of society, without there being some incredibly strong, compelling reason, is a complete, it's a moral crime. And we should be absolutely ashamed. It's totally, utterly wrong. And the answer, I mean, I think if your view is, well, these people need to be detained, then you say, well, we need to build family detention centers and keep people in family detention centers, which is, you know, its own shitty, crappy solution. But it's certainly better than the wrenching of children from parents, which is, all you need to do is just to imagine yourself. All you need to do is think, like, what would happen if I was just told not to hit the table? All that you can do is, I mean, you imagine that. I mean, Secretary Yes. Nielsen has kids and John Kelly has kids, and it's a fucking outrage.
When what Secretary Nielsen said is, like, well, these families are being treated the same way as people who commit crimes in the United States and parents go to prison. But that's not true, because if you're seeking asylum, you are not committing a crime. And we've also lost sight of the conditions in some home countries that are leading people to be so desperate as to make this dangerous journey and then submit to what we're doing right now. Like, it has not been a picnic for a very long time.
I think one thing that comes to mind for me is that the United States does make a choice in its budget to give money to countries all around the world where we have decided that it's part of our role in the world to help the starving, the sick, the poor, the malnourished all over the world. And so we give money to other people, even though it doesn't directly help us. It seems to me that this should be thought of in the same way, that the country makes a choice that keeping families together is a morally good thing to do. It's expensive, but it's expensive to give money to people who are suffering from famine as well. So it's handling them humanely is in keeping with all kinds of policies that the U.S. has in all kinds of other places as well. Even though this is obviously in the hyper politically charged area of the border, it seems to me that the values that are a part of humane giving in other areas should pertain here, just for consistency's sake. And then secondly, the ripping apart puts them into a system it's a system that can't handle. So we can't handle keeping the families together, but the system's not handling ripping them apart either, because you've got parents who can't find their children. Nobody knows where their children are. The children are then into a system where they can't get advocacy for them, and it's overloading that system. So it's not like the thing they're being thrown into is going to be less costly and less ruinous as it deals with these cases.
I just don't understand how conservatives who have made such a big deal about the family and the idea of the family as the defining unit can be so cavalier in this case. It makes me sick. I mean, these are our ancestors. These are our parents and our grandparents and it's wrong. And I think, again, I think you can believe in a quite restrictive immigration policy, which I don't, but you can believe in a quite restrictive immigration policy and still know that this is a moral crime. It's horrible. Anyway, so Slate Plus members, you get extra segments with all Slate podcasts, including this one. You can be a Slate Plus member for just $35 a year and support Slate's journalism. Our extra Slate Plus segment today will be about the sins of the fathers, the sins of our parents. So Fred Trump, Donald Trump's father, may have been arrested at a KKK rally during the 1920s. Should that be held against his son in any way? When should the sins of your relatives be visited upon politicians and celebrities? Go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member and get this Slate Plus segment and other ones.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th only on Hulu.
The toll taken by Hurricane Maria on Puerto Rico is much, much, much worse than the government has admitted. Federal government has said that 64 people died because of that storm. A new estimate from the Harvard School of Public Health, or scientists associated with Harvard School of Public Health, suggests that 4,600 people may have died as a result of the hurricane and the disruptions to healthcare and power and water in the months after the storm. That number is an estimate. It could be more, it could be less. But what has become clear is that Hurricane Maria was the most catastrophic event of the Trump presidency, possibly the second worst natural disaster in United States history. But
are
it
you
is,
comparing it to Katrina and saying that?
No, the Galveston. Isn't the Galveston flood is the one that had the worst. Greatest cost of life?
And that was in 1900-something, right?
Yeah.
So we're going back a little.
Yeah, much worse than
Katrina.
Potentially, in human cost.
Right. As far, I mean, it's hard to tell because Katrina was 1,800 deaths, and there's a sort of span here, right? Yeah. But it appears that way.
But in any case, it's essentially a footnote to what's been happening elsewhere in this country, and particularly around the Trump presidency. So, first of all, do we know that 4,600 people died?
No, we have a really clever study in which a whole lot of Harvard grad students, it sounds like, a whole lot of researchers fanned out in Puerto Rico. They tried to make it representative and stratified. So they went all over the country and they tried to very carefully survey people and then make sure they were getting a representative sample. And they went to about 3,300 homes and then they found... I think it was like around 38 deaths. And then they extrapolated from that. And so what they come up with...
In the 3 months after, during the hurricane and the 3 months after the hurricane.
Right. And the 3 months after is important because one of the things they found is that a lot of deaths seem to be caused by interrupted medical services, which makes a lot of sense given all the things we know about the way the island's electricity was knocked out and so many things didn't function. So then they came up with a kind of spectrum of number, right, that goes from like 800 deaths all the way up to more than 8,000 as sort of a possible range. And then they're kind of best guesstimate is in above 4,000, and it has what's called a confidence interval of 95%. And that's like the way you do a study like this. It's not the same thing, obviously, as going around and counting every single person, but it tries to give what's due to these places that have been underinvestigated and underreported. And I think we should also add the New York Times looked through all the vital statistics for Puerto Rico in this time period, and they found it was like an extra 1,052 deaths, more than would be expected. Because obviously, like in a 3 month period, some people would have died absent the hurricane.
And also, just as a marker, and GW is doing another study too, which is coming out in a couple of weeks about how many died. So we should have a pretty, I mean, we know we should have a range here of how
the
many
GW
died.
One has the government's Puerto Rican government support, Puerto Rican, I think,
right?
Which the Harvard one did not.
Right, the Harvard one just went around the government because they were having trouble getting any data.
Yeah,
John, in what sense does the Trump administration have culpability for these deaths? Why is it not just sort of bad luck and climate change?
Well, this to me is I spent a lot of time thinking about the Puerto Rican question when I was working on the cover for The Atlantic, because there are two ways in which presidents and administrations are responsible. There's the actual responsibility. How much does the federal government have to responsibility to clean up and then to anticipate the collateral effects of when a disaster hits a place? And you know that it has bad infrastructure, and you know that that's then going to lead to the interruption of medical care. And so what are you doing? What's your actual responsibility? I've looked around. There's a lot of assertion that they're on the hook. But then you say, okay, for not doing X, Y, and Z. That's hard to find. That's hard to find a specific. I'm not saying it's – I'm really anxious to find out what, you know, specific things did they not do that another administration might have done or that they would have done – in, say, Houston versus Puerto Rico. We can get to the race question in a minute. So there's that. part of presidential and administrative responsibility. There's a second part that's purely symbolic. And that is basically what happened with President Obama with the BP oil spill. So obviously the federal government had nothing to do with the fact that the Horizon 10 oil platform blew up and that there was a big gushing hole of oil into the ocean. However, at the time, the president's approval rating dropped as a result of his inability to plug up the hole. Peggy Noonan wrote an editorial. There were lots of editorials. She wrote, you know, he was supposed to be competent, arguing that Obama, in not plugging the hole, was showing that he was incompetent as a president. People called it Obama's Katrina, even though he had nothing to do with the initiating event. How does this relate to Puerto Rico? President Trump could say, look, Puerto Rico had horrible infrastructure. They had corrupt local governments that didn't do the preparation work. And so all of these deaths are the result of the fact that Puerto Rico is a special case. It's not like Houston, and therefore I shouldn't be on the hook for this. But A, Obama was on the hook. So why, if he's on the hook for an oil spill, is Trump not? And then there's the second thing. When you talk to Obama administration officials about the BP oil spill, they would say, look, yeah, it was no picnic. But in the American government, there is no one complaint window people can go to when there is a sense of national outrage about something. And, you know, you got to suck it up when you're president. You are the complaint window. You are the person that has to go fix this or be in charge of fixing it. Because when people have this kind of sense of outrage, they can't go to the senator for Tennessee to get it fixed. And so this is just a part of the role of the presidency, to be the national complaint window. With President Trump, none of that is applied. Either the specific penalty for specific things he could have done wrong, or the kind of complaint window thing hasn't applied. And I that fascinates me. I have some theories, but that's enough of me talking.
Well, but so one thing that's different about Puerto Rico is, of course, it is not a state. It has no senators in any case. It's detached from the contiguous 48 states, so there's not a lot of media coverage of it. There aren't a lot of reporters there, and people like us, I have paid no attention at all. Here I am outraged at this death toll. Have I spent 1 minute in the last 4 months thinking a lot about Puerto Rico? No, I haven't. And so is there a moral culpability on the part of all of us?
Yes, I think you can definitely put some of the blame on the 48 contiguous states and some on the press. Although I have to say, the press went. I mean, I feel like we can't lose sight of that. They did some really tough reporting. It was not me, but there were reporters who really did that.
And David Begno of CBS he's like the mayor of Puerto Rico.
Log rolling.
I know, but it's
CBS
for real. I mean, he won, like, this is why he won a Polk Award for his coverage of Puerto Rico. He went down after this. I mean, it's really been incredibly proud to, you know, I have nothing to do with
I'm
it,
kidding.
But to
I'm
be associated
kidding,
with that. And so I think there has been, but, you know, as we all know, you can write and work on a story really hard and you see that actually people on the other end of it are not either watching or getting outraged or turning it into a response. Just because, so there's two people to look at, both the creators of the media and then the people reading about it.
Yeah. I mean, look, there is no question that we did not engage with Puerto Rico as the kind of national drama and emergency the way we did with Katrina, the way we did with the hurricane in Houston. And that was not all the Trump administration, but the Trump administration certainly played into that. And, you know, I think the lasting image most of us have of President Trump is throwing paper towels into this audience, a gesture which seems, you know, wholly inadequate at best and utterly insensitive at not best. So, you know, the idea that, like, there was more to be done. I guess, John, I want to go back to your theories about why you think Trump has been essentially, or relatively speaking, let off the hook. Is it just like part of our Pall Mall chaos or something else going on?
I don't know. And we should note again that the president, just one other beat on the kind of president and his relationship to this, is that at one point he said, nobody could have done what I've done for Puerto Rico with so little appreciation. So he has tried to take, before these numbers, I can't remember when he said that, but it was a while ago. He has tried to take credit for what the federal government has done for Puerto Rico. So he recognizes or thinks he should get credit for it. So if he gets credit, then should he now get the blame? I think the reason that he hasn't, well, I got a couple of things. One, he may be getting the blame. I mean, his approval ratings are not sky high. Two, I think it is the Pell Mell. I think it is both the media is distracted by the daily craziness, and I think readers and viewers are distracted by the daily craziness on either two fronts. One front is, oh my gosh, what's the latest thing with the Mueller investigation? Or, Oh my gosh, I'm hearing constantly about the, you know, the incompetence or the malfeasance or the investigation, and so one more piece of bad news, even though it may be more morally important when you're talking about actual deaths of people, it just gets all kind of in the noise and gets lost in that. And then there's, I think, to the points that David was making, it's not, Puerto Rico is not like, you know, Houston or Florida or the places we normally see where the nation gets involved in the drama. And that's, there's obviously a, you know, the racial piece to that.
Although I was thinking about this because I remember when we did a show or did an had a conversation about Puerto Rico months ago, I think I said something about how I actually didn't think of Puerto Ricans in the same way I thought of Texans or Connecticut.
And I hope you got blowback from that.
Not, less than you'd think. But I actually realized that I kind of feel the same way about Alaskans and Hawaiians, that actually my sense of America is really
contiguous.
It's contiguous.
Can I use a word improperly? You need to grow your sense of America. This is part of America. Like, come
well,
on.
He's
why
admitting
are you
that.
Being so? That's you, what I'm encouraging him to move beyond admitting it to shifting.
Well,
but I don't. I think it makes sense. Like, it makes perfect sense that if when things are geographically far flung, that you feel less sense of common cause with them.
But California is also geographically far flung from the East Coast and vice versa. And like, we know we're all connected.
Yeah. Well, Puerto Rico is also not a state, and that actually has weight. And it's probably, and there's probably racism. Like it's probably some form of implicit racism.
And leftover colonialism also. I mean, Puerto Rico has a different status for all these like embedded historical reasons that are uncomfortable.
Yeah. I think that the most important result of, well, I think there are two hugely important results, but political result from this is that hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans seem to have moved to Florida in particular. And there may be a significant block of voters who are going to be really pissed, who are going to be voting on issues. And that could make a difference in certain congressional races and in the even presidential election.
And in the governor's, and the race, governor's race in Florida, and in a really important ballot initiative to restore the vote to disenfranchised former felons.
The reason we want to know the answer to this is obviously to keep it from happening again. And also, it should not be possible that this many people die and it just kind of, you know, it goes on kind of, I mean, we're remarking upon it, but I've been really frustrated in the way in which it's hard to say, like, here are specific things that should have been done. It does seem like it would have been easy to anticipate the interruptions of medical service that happened as a result of this afterwards. And so who should have been, is the governor of Puerto Rico who should have been on the case there? And who is the office at FEMA where the person should have said, you know, we're going to, because this happened in Katrina, this happened with the nursing homes. It's always happening with the nursing homes when the electricity goes out. So didn't somebody say, oh my God, this electricity stuff's going to murder people in, you know, nursing homes or who are rely on electricity to stay alive? And then where did that memo go? Like, and did nobody, surely somebody said, hey, this is going to be a problem. And anyway, so I can't wait for that information to be found.
In closing on this, one other thought I had, because I'm a horrible person, is
you're just more honest than most of
that
us.
That I wonder if this is the, and I think, again, actually, I think I feel like I'm reprising something I've said before, but that this is, that Puerto Rico is the kind of canary in the coal mine around climate refugees. I have a colleague who just went to the island of Montserrat. Montserrat is another Caribbean island that had an active volcano. The volcano destroyed a huge amount of the island a few years ago. And actually, so its population cut from 12,000 to 3,000.
Wow.
And, you know, it's climbed back up a little bit, but it's a shell of what it was because it has this extremely dangerous volcano on it that has nothing to do with climate change. But I feel like the Caribbean, because it's in the path of all these storms, is in a tenuous situation. And it may be that it's really hard to maintain rich, prosperous, you know, infrastructure, functional economies in those places. Well, and that people are going to, if they want to have a higher quality of life and standard of living, they may have to leave.
Yeah, this is the Jack Schaefer's piece that he wrote after Katrina, basically saying
don't repair New Orleans.
Yeah. It's geographically situated in a place that's going to, you know, that was, it was, he got a lot of blowback for that. there's a certainty this is going to happen again in Puerto Rico. And when you read the stories about what they're doing to restore electricity and the kind of pell-mell rush to try to get the lights on, which is, of course, important, but it's just like it's not sustainable for when this hits again.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Roseanne is gone from the airwaves at ABC. The rebooted sitcom was canceled on Tuesday, just hours after star Roseanne Barr sent a racist tweet about former Obama aide Valerie Jarrett. This tweet, of course, followed close on the heels of an anti-Semitic tweet about George Soros that she'd sent. And she has a long history of saying and tweeting disgusting things about people. I am surprised, actually, how few people have risen to her defense, that even on the right, there has been very little grand speak out on behalf of her free speech rights, on the political correctness that has wiped out her show.
Really? I feel like there was a wave of what about all these mean things that various comedians and celebrities have said about conservatives. Why is this any different? The usual, you know, accusations about political correctness taking over the debate. Trump, while he complained about ABC not apologizing to him or not whatever. Yeah, I guess that was it. Hasn't made it a kind of rallying cry the way he could have, but I don't know.
Participate in this argument by saying that there's an equivalence between comparing the president to an orangutan and using a centuries old racist construction to talk about a black
Valerie
person.
Jarrett.
Like, are you even allowed in the conversation?
Well, everyone's allowed into the conversation, a lot of, like, the water is lapping at your feet.
Yeah,
the island is eroding beneath
you. It's just not.
It's not
really
a serious argument.
That equivalence is really an admission of something you don't want to be admitting.
Yeah, that you know,
a person, right,
you're willfully ignorant of history.
Yeah, and willfully ignorant of what makes it different when you're talking about someone being criticized for the color of their skin, which they cannot control, and someone being criticized in the normal. It's so dispiriting to see that.
Well, but yes. I don't think so there's some whataboutism, but there's not very much defense of her. There's nobody who's sort of defending anything that she said, right?
Not much, I guess. I mean, there was that insane Bill Mitchell tweet that was like trying to make it compliment. It was ridiculous.
Yeah,
forget
that.
Okay, that's all I can come up with right now. I mean, look, defending overt racism is something that most people don't want to do. Even now, she managed to cross a line, though she was being given a lot of leeway. I also think the anti-Semitic stuff was appalling because she was accusing George Soros of having abetted the Nazis when he was a child in hiding at the time. And that is another just like utter distortion of history that is.
Arm people for why that's a distortion of history.
Well, because.
Some people don't.
Right. Because don't, like the Nazis murdered many, many Jews. There were Jews who were collaborators. That is like a small fraction, a complicated history. If you were a person who survived in hiding as a child, the notion that you were somehow complicit or responsible. And this is also a smear that's been used to discredit George Soros for many years because he is giving money to liberal causes that conservatives like Roseanne Barr don't like.
And he was 13 years old when he was
in hiding
from the Nazis.
Yes.
I mean.
So one of the points about this Roseanne controversy that has made liberals so happy is that the show Roseanne, the rebooted show Roseanne, depicts her character her husband's character as economically anxious people who are kind of culturally tolerant. They're rough around the edges, but they're basically...
And they're Trump supporters.
They're Trump supporters, but they're culturally tolerant. But that's run smack into the person of Roseanne Barr, who is not economically anxious
or culturally tolerant.
And she's not, she's a racist. She's an anti-Semite. She's a viciously intolerant person. And so I think that liberals are enjoying this fact that one of the most celebrated Trumpists is turning out to be the bigot that they suspect lots of Trump voters are, and that this claim of economic anxiety as a driver of Trump support is not true, and therefore Roseanne's the show they were irritated by the show Roseanne for that reason. Does this vindicate that view? Does it vindicate the idea that Trump supporters are driven by racism and cultural war?
It's
one person, and to define an entire group by the worst behavior of one of its members is awful. Now separate and apart from that, in a separate thing that is also true, is there's been a lot of analysis and a lot of study of the Trump voters and the role of race and the feeling about immigrants taking jobs and the role of people of color taking jobs from people who are either self-identified Trump supporters or who agree with a lot of his campaign promises. There was a significant number that were motivated in surveys and interviews by those feelings about the other, more so than about wage levels rising and other things that Donald Trump might have been saying. So that there is some evidence separate and apart from this whole conversation that there were race-based motivations behind some of the opinions of the Trump supporters. But that is separate and apart from this.
Do you guys watch this TV show, and is this a loss? Like, was it a good thing to have a depiction on television of white Trump supporters that was three-dimensional and had empathy in it? And I ask this as someone who has not watched 1 minute of the old Roseanne or the new Roseanne, and you can see that as like my blindness to white Trump supporters, but I will also say I've watched not 1 minute of like almost every network television show in the last 30 years. So,
well, I watched the premiere of the new one. Katana was watching it for something, and I found it just terrible and tedious. But I didn't find it terrible and tedious because I thought it was so politically back atswards or anything. I just, that format of
the sitcom,
the sitcom, and with the studio laugh track is a deadly formula in the age of modern television. So I don't feel
it's
like
hard
I can make,
for you to be like, I miss this
critical
show.
Judgment.
Yeah.
My critical judgment is, man, that form is terrible, but I don't know if the show was terrible.
Right. You were making an art judgment, not a political judgment. I liked the fact that it was out there in the world with a huge following. I like that it was pushing back against the liberal groupthink of the entertainment industry. The show. This is the show.
Yes, yes.
Itself.
But good to clarify.
But I can hear, you know, people rushing to social media.
Why do you think they've pulled all the old episodes also off the air? I don't think that she's a Cosby. Why is it that the show that existed in the 90s can no longer be aired? It can no longer be seen by free-thinking people?
Yeah.
Well, isn't that a marketing decision that they're just trying to...
Sure.
Yeah. So it's just about dollars and cents.
I don't
right?
actually think that pulling Cosby reruns, I mean, I guess reruns, I guess you, right, do you want money to be going? But like the notion that we have to lose all the past work because of the sins of the present when these are shows that were historically important. Like if you were writing the history of, what is this, 90s TV, the same way with 80s TV, you would include it with the Cosby show. Like, I don't know, that always seems weird to me. On the other hand, I don't like the idea of lining the pockets of racists.
What would be wrong with recasting the show with somebody else playing that character?
I don't think anything at all. I think it would be great.
They should do that.
Yeah.
Be volunteering.
I'm a middle-aged man, not a middle-aged woman.
Not traditional
casting. You could do it.
Thanks.
Also, from my viewing the show, I thought it could have been more cleverly done and more cleverly convey the complexity and worldview of the people to whom that show was either supposed to be speaking or speaking for. I mean, I thought it was a failure in art by the target it was trying to hit. But then again, what the hell do I know? You know, I mean,
quite a lot, actually.
Well, no, but what do I know about what appeals to huge, you know, millions and millions of people in a sitcom? My standard is different.
You do host a show on network television.
Well,
so
I know, but I
think your qualifications to judge are somewhat better than almost anybody else.
Who knows? I don't know.
All right.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. we need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Let us go to cocktail chatter. When you are spewing racist garbage on your porch, no, that would never happen. When you are
yeah, I really hope not. I get in big trouble in my neighborhood for that.
When you are
plus, you would find it morally repugnant, sanctimonious
liberal things on your porch. Thank Emily Bazelon, what will you be chatting?
You have my number. Before I answer that question, I am going to try a new thing this morning.
Ooh,
we are going to try.
What new thing?
We are going to try having listener chatter this morning. And we are going to draw this chatter from tweets that are tweeted at the Slate Gabfest handle. We're just going to pick something we like, some small, hopefully entertaining little item. And today comes from Drew Reads the News. That's the Twitter handle. And he wrote in, "Hey, Slate Gabfest, just now getting around to reading my May issue of The Atlantic with Dickerson's article. And whose name do I see but Emily Bazelon? Page 13. Where are you at, David Plotz? You in this magazine too?" So I got this tweet and was like, huh, I'm going to confess I let my print subscription to The Atlantic run out, which was bad. And I still don't know what I'm doing on page 13. I hope it's something kind of nice. And yeah, David, they should have written about it.
Why haven't you just Googled I'm sure that whatever article's in print is on the online.
I kind of tried for a minute and I couldn't figure it out fast. Maybe you'll figure it out. Or maybe Drew Reads the News can write back to us.
In any case, listeners, if you've got a great tweet, if you have a chatter that you want to share with us, it could be about the show, but it could be about some wonderful thing that we should observe.
And I promise I won't always pick one that are always, secretly about promoting myself.
Yes. But tweet at Slate Gabfest and we'll share one in coming weeks.
All right. My own chatter is about abortion rights. We had a kind of bifurcated week. It started with Ireland ending its ban on abortion to the celebration of a great deal of people, and a lot of them women, in Ireland. And an amazingly lopsided vote, more than 65% of the country voting to end this ban, which is just really interesting in terms of Ireland's Catholic history and the decision by voters that having a total ban on abortion is too much. And so that is really a landmark. On the other hand, here in the United States, we have states passing abortion restrictions that would appear to be clearly illegal under Roe versus Wade, 15-week bans in Mississippi, and I think one got struck down in Iowa. There's a 6-week ban in some state. And I can't decide if this is surprising, but the Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal of a case in Arkansas about a law in Arkansas that has banned medical abortion. So this is when you take pills instead of having a surgical procedure. The effect of this ruling right now is to close 2 of the 3 clinics in Arkansas, and it would seem to be wholly at odds, this law, with the Supreme Court's ruling in 2015, which was about a very similar and more onerous set of regulations in Texas that also severely decreased access to abortion in the kind of fake name of protecting women's health. This is like identical. And yet we have the Eighth Circuit, the Court of Appeals, upholding this law, at least for now, sending it back to the district court judge who had struck down the law, telling the district court judge that she didn't make enough factual findings about how many women were going to be affected. So essentially, the Eighth Circuit seemed to be daring the Supreme Court about whether it really meant what it said in the 2015 case, which is called Whole Women's Health. And the Supreme Court said, you guys work it out. We're not getting involved right now. It just seems like a strange sign and a bad sign for people who care about access to abortion, because it sort of invites other states and other lower courts to mess around with what seemed to be a pretty clear ruling in 2015. So we should be watching this.
I found the article about you, Emily. It was a quote in a Connor Friedersdorf piece.
Yeah. All right. Nice. Hopefully.
About some story you did about how Republicans learned to love working mothers.
Oh, yeah. Ivanka Trump. I remember that. Okay. Thank you.
John, what's your chatter?
My chatter is, it's about some photographs, but it's based on a place you can go look at these photographs. Well, A, if you're in San Francisco, you can go look at them at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. But if you're not there, you can read the piece in The New Yorker by Louis Menand.
Yes.
Okay. I wasn't sure whether I was pronouncing that right. And it's about these photographs. And what they are is they are photographs taken from Bobby Kennedy's funeral train in June of 1968 as it went from New York to Washington. And on that train, and so he was going from St. Patrick's, where his funeral was held, to Arlington Cemetery, where he was to be buried next to his brother. And on that train was a photographer for Look magazine. And that photographer is Paul Fusco. He photographed the people along the roadside, or excuse me, along the train side, who had just come to pay their respects to Kennedy. And it is just an amazing, the photos themselves are amazing about all the different kinds of people, all different shapes and sizes, men, women, black, white, young, old. It's also a snapshot of America in that time, which is fascinating just in terms of what America looked like. But then as art, what he did was, because the train is moving, the light is going down, he can't take a quick snap of the people or they will look blurred. So what he did was he moved his camera as he was shooting to try to compensate for the movement of the train, which was going rather slow because people wanted to pay their respects. But he moved the camera in such a way that what happens is that the photographs capture one or two faces in perfect clarity. And yet around them is this blurred image of America at the time. So there is a lot going on in these photographs, and they're worth just kind of sitting on and reflecting on. And then obviously the question becomes, could there be a politician about whom, you know, who would have this kind of a turnout? And then I think if you want to challenge yourself, there are a lot of people who I interviewed somebody because I'm doing a piece about this for CBS. I went down to interview some people along the track who watched it all up and down the Eastern Seaboard. And one of the people I interviewed said they, you know, loved the Kennedys because it was the first Irish president. And it wasn't because this person was a Democrat. It wasn't because this person had a deep feeling about really much of anything other than it was a tribal affiliation. So in the Kennedy support, there is this tribal affiliation to the Kennedys, which extended to Teddy Kennedy, which liberal heroes, when they hear Trump supporters say the same essentially tribal things about their president, they think it's a sign of the basically stupidity and dim-wittedness of the Trump supporter. And so if you want to challenge yourself, put your, you know, reverse that. And that's, you know, that's just another thing that sort of occurred to me. But of course, just the beauty of this and the solemnity is the much more important point.
Very cool.
My chatter is actually two chatters. First, in the New York Times this week, as the Mueller investigation nears a crescendo, and as Robert Mueller is perhaps gearing up to interview the president, the Times looked back to the last time a president was interviewed by a special counsel, and Peter Baker, who's the Times' absolutely marvelous, brilliant political correspondent, continues to be a White House correspondent today, but he was the best correspondent covering the Clinton White House even back in the 90s, recounts through an oral history what happened when Ken Starr's team quizzed Bill Clinton about Monica Lewinsky. There's all kinds of great drama in the piece. There's the way in which the White House seems to get the audio disabled so that the grand jury is not able to ask questions, even though the grand jury was supposed to be able to ask direct questions. There's the fact that the people in the room didn't realize at the time what a big deal it was that Clinton said, that depends on the meaning of the word is, what the word of the meaning of word is. And then there's this post-testimony speech, which I had forgotten. I don't know if you remember this, John, but a post-testimony speech where Clinton sort of admitted wrongdoing and then excoriated the Starr investigation, which I did not remember him doing that, but I guess he did.
Yeah, I forgot the specific one as well. I mean, I definitely remember that he attacked Starr.
So anyway, I would commend to you this really excellent piece in the Times by Peter Baker about that. And then my other quick chatter is just about a book that another Slate podcaster and former Slate colleague of ours, Mike Pesca, I mean, Mike is still at Slate, we're not, has done. It's called Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History. And Mike has gathered 30 or so wonderful writers to write often very funny, speculative essays and sometimes comic pieces about what would have happened had some certain sporting events gone differently. So what, for example, would have happened if the U.S. had boycotted Hitler's Olympics? What would have happened if Bobby Riggs had actually beaten Billie Jean King? And there's another one, which is what if the Dodgers had never moved to L.A.? And in fact, Mike is also doing a podcast in association with a book, and he had Robert Siegel of NPR did the what if the Dodgers had never moved to L.A. as a feature story for that podcast, which is also very charming. So you should check out Pesca's book upon further review. That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Izzy Rode. You can follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest, and in fact, tweet at us with some chatter of yours, some wonderful point that we should observe, make in the next show. So at @SlateGabFest, and we will pick one of those for examination and review next week. For Emily and John, I'm David Plotz. Thank you for listening. We will talk to you next week, and hopefully we'll see you in Philadelphia on July 18th. Go to slate.com/live to get tickets for that show.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.